live and in color from the NBC News Radio Broadcasting Studios of KCAA, 1050 AM, 102.3 FM, and 106.5 FM, located in beautiful Southern California, and in parallel from the Turf Sup Radio Studio in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Thanks for tuning in to the Water Zone Show this evening.
Well, good afternoon again, and welcome to the Water Zone Show. I'm your host, Rob Starr, along with our other special host. I call him special because he's a great guy, but Chris Davey. Chris, how are you tonight?
Great. Thanks for the introduction. You're just as awesome as well, Rob. So, out in Arizona there, how are you doing?
I'm doing fine. It was a nice 108 degrees today, but beautiful.
But it is.
We've got a nice... Got a nice
but at least you know your state is open. In California here, we are open sometimes and we're closed, but only on Tuesdays when the moon is full and your aunt in Poughkeepsie is getting carbuncle surgery.
Well, that's why I left there the other day to come back to Arizona, because I think that if I wanted a haircut, I couldn't get one there, so I had to come back here for that. But no, it's great. You know, things are what it is all over. It's just for our listeners, we're all broadcasting from all over the country right now, and but it's just... you know, we got to get adjusted to it. We haven't been to the radio station since March, so that's different.
Several months.
So, but for anybody who wants to call in and talk to us, it's on the toll free line. It's 888-909-1050, or if you're local to Southern California, it's 909-792-5222. We have a great guest today, and seeing what's happened in the water news. What amazes me, and we're going to introduce Ms. Chris Austin, who's always a regular on the show. She's part of the show. She is the show. And she talks about everything that happens in California with water. It's like having an Encyclopedia Britannica every day pops up on my computer, and I read this Maven's notebook, and things that you don't hear about, because all of us don't get to go to these meetings or hear what's going on. And even the general public doesn't know what's going on behind the scenes. Chris is right on top of it. She's got to win some. There's got to be an award for what she does somewhere in radio for the news and things that she brings about California water news. It's unbelievable. So without further ado, I want to bring on the big boss of Maven's Notebook, Ms. Chris Austin.
Hey, how you doing, guys?
Great, Chris. Thank you.
Yeah, it's been. You know, I'll just get right to it. They're right 30 minutes before we go on the air, that I'm posting this breaking water news that has to do with the Klamath Dam removal project. You know, that's okay. The largest dam removal project in the United States. Four dams on the Klamath River. Now, these dams have some reservoirs behind them, but they're not water supply dams. They're hydroelectric dams. And the Klamath River is a little bit different situation, because most rivers start high in the mountains and kind of go down to the valley and go low. But the Klamath River starts, you know, in the mountains, and it's a very steep decline to the Pacific Ocean. It goes through some very unique topography, which made it really ideal to develop hydropower dams on that river. And so there are four of them in sequence. Again, these are just providing power to customers in Oregon and a few in Northern California. They're not water supply dams. And having these dams on the river has caused a lot of we now know about toxic algae blooms because they're all over the place. But before they became all over the place, they were actually quite commonplace behind these dams on the Klamath River. So there were a lot of reasons to get rid of them. The dams, having been built in like the 50s and 60s, they kind of came up for what's, you know, known as relicensing by FERC. And when the dam goes through the relicensing, then, you know, other conditions get put on that dam. And if they wanted to continue to operate these dams, they were going to have to put in fish ladders. And, like, again, I go back to, it's very steep topography, and these dams are very high. And putting in fish ladders on four dams. Not all of them are as high, but I think at least two are. They're really steep. Would be a huge expense. And again, these are hydropower dams in a remote location, and so they weren't always economically great dams anyways, or they haven't turned out to be, at least in terms of with all the other things that are competing nowadays with solar and wind. And so Pacific Corps said, okay, we won't relicense them. We'll let you remove them, but Pacific Corps really wanted to be, Pacific Corps is the owner of the dams. They really wanted to be released from any liability should something go horribly wrong. So they came up with this complicated idea where they transferred ownership of the dam to this temporary corporation called the Klamath River Renewal Corporation. And this corporation went out and they they got an insurance company that would insure the whole process, and the goal was to indemnify Pacific Corps, transfer it over to this insurance company, and this corporation would remove the dams, and then the corporation would disband. So if anything went wrong, then really the insurance company was the one holding the bag, and the Klamath River Renewal Corporation would probably be disbanded, and Pacific Corps would not be liable. And basically FERC said, well, you can remove the dams, but Pacific Corps has to remain on the hook. And they made this decision today. So that's actually, kind of big.
Well, I can't see an insurance company knowing about the ineffectiveness and the age and all of that, that they'd want to take on that kind of responsibility.
Yeah, they found an insurance company that was, and this was all sort of set up, and it was very unique and, was groundbreaking in the design of this, and I think they were hoping that it could be a model for other dam removals where perhaps people were hesitant or corporations were hesitant to remove them because of, liabilities downstream, flood control or water quality or, who knows what happens. So they were really hoping this would be a model. And so FERC has kind of, thrown a wrench in that piece of machinery. So we'll have to see. I know that the people on the Klamath River are very dedicated to having these dams removed. Pacific Corps doesn't want to have to relicense them and put in fish ladders, so they're probably going to have to somehow agree to remain on the hook somewhat in order to make this happen. But we'll have to see what happens now to this project. In the coming weeks, we'll probably know more.
So do you think, I don't know about the ethics about this or the legalities of it, but wouldn't an insurance company, in a case like this, I would kind of think that they'd have to put up some sort of more than just a guarantee so they don't go belly up themselves, and then nobody takes care of anything. Would they have to put money up in some, escrow account just in case something happened?
I haven't been able to dig back. I was trying to find the decision at FERC, but if this is chiseled, this there is probably like pages and pages, this legal stuff. But yeah, somehow, they're not happy with Pacific Corps being off the hook. So, yeah. I mean, bottom line is Pacific Corps is going to have to sign on to this somehow, so that they can make this happen. I mean, they kind of can't go back. They already know they don't want to put fish ladders on those dams. The dams are problematic because they cause water quality problems. I mean, they're not without their their pros, they did supply some power to people in the area, and they had reservoirs backed up behind them. And so there are people that have bought vacation houses around, you know, quote-unquote lakes that aren't going to be there anymore. So that's a bit of a problem, you know, for them. But basically, that, you know, there's a lot of benefits to removing these dams, I think, in terms of water quality, in terms of restoring the salmon runs. And so, you know, and they have overwhelming support, majority support in the region. It's not complete. It's not total. There are people up there that are opposed to the dams being removed, but they're not really opposed to them being removed as much as they're opposed to the funding changes that will come. Because, like, for instance, Pacific Corps had the dams, and so they paid taxes into Siskiyou County, which is a rural and a poor county as compared relative to other counties in California. And so Siskiyou County used that money for their school system. But now that money's going away. So how can a poor rural county replace this funding that's no longer going to be there because these dams are no longer going to be there? I'm not sure they have really solved that problem yet either. So, you know, it's not universally supported up there. There are people that have some very real concerns, but I would say the majority of people and stakeholders in the region are supportive of the dams being removed. And they actually reached agreement on this several years ago, and with a number of agencies and organizations, they negotiated a whole agreement to everything being removed, and all it needed was the Congress to give this agreement its blessing, and they couldn't get it through Congress. Particularly Congressman Doug LaMalfa, who is a congressman in that area, very opposed to these being removed, as is Congressman McClintock, Tom McClintock. Again, I understand the funding reasons, but these are not water supply dams. They're not taking water away from anybody, but they are taking funding in some areas. But keeping them there, then you have toxic algae problems, and the salmon runs continue to suffer. So, we'll see where it goes from here. You know, overwhelming support for it, or I should say majority support for it, but not universal support, because there's a lot of issues, you know.
Mm-hmm. A lot to be had. And they got to peg everything down to the dollar. I mean, you know, the Klamath River Renewal Corporation, they're a nonprofit to begin with. So, you know, there's...
Yes, and the money that they have received for the dam removal is kind of set in stone. Back in, I think it was 2011, when was it, when we passed Prop 1 for water projects, there was $225 million for Klamath Dam removal. And Pacific Corps put a tax on all of its customers for a certain amount, and they raised the same amount. So this corporation has exactly $450 million to remove these dams, and if they can't get them removed for that price tag, I'm not sure they really have a plan B. They've been trying to come up with a plan B. At least when I wrote about it, I don't know, 6-8 months ago, they didn't have a plan B. But they knew they had to come up with something. But I imagine whatever their plan B was did not satisfy FERC, who, you know, said Pacific Corps has to stay on the hook. So,
well, just more news that we'll find out about as we go further. Hey, one of the biggest things that obviously everybody talks about, aside from COVID-19 and the election coming up, is about what the weather change, you know, climate change. And from what I read in your post today about bigger, badder storms are coming in the years ahead for California. So is that something we're going to be ready for, do you think?
Well, I mean, we've been trying. We've been knowing about this. Another term for this is weather whiplash. If you think about it, you know, we had one of the driest years in our multi-year drought, which was then followed by the wettest year on record, according to most statistics. I mean, to go from severely dry to severely wet, you know, there have been several studies that have come out that have looked at this and said this is what we're headed for. You know, with climate change, what we're talking about is reduced snowpack in the mountains, more storms coming in and dropping rain instead of snow. And that's a challenge for California because our water infrastructure is set up to maximize snow up in the mountains in the winter. That melts nice and slowly and fills our streams and rivers in the hot summer and the dry fall. And that's what we live off of. And that's not going to be there for us anymore. So we have to make some fundamental changes in our water system to capture rain as it falls. And to put it off into reservoirs or into groundwater storage, you know, wherever we can store that. It's really going to be key to the future. It's also key to solving our groundwater problem. And there's been a lot of research on this, taking flood flows and you know, routing them onto farm fields and letting them soak into the ground and into the aquifers that way to replenish them. But, yeah, it is the way it's going to go in the future. We're going to, you know, have wetter wets and drier dry years, and we're probably going to have more dry years than we have wet years. And when we have wet years, it's going to be, you know, hold on to your umbrella and your raincoat and keep your Noah's Ark docked by the side of your house. You know, it's going to be, so we can expect some severe storms, I think. We've already seen that.
Well, they keep telling me next month here in Arizona we start getting monsoon weather, so it's going to be interesting. Well, Chris, we're up against our commercials, and we want to thank you for joining us, as you always do, as part of our show. You're one of the premier people that we always like to hear from. And again, to our listeners, please go to www.maidensnotebook.com. Be a subscriber. Help support that. You'll learn more about water from her than anybody else in California. She knows everything, everybody. That's why we hang with her, because, you know, we're only as good as the people we hang with. So Chris, thank you very much for joining us again. We appreciate it. We'll talk to you next week.
Okay. Good evening, everyone.
Take care, Chris.
You too.
Good evening. All right, we're going to take a little break, and then we're going to talk a little bit more about climate change in Minnesota and see what they've come up with. So we'll be right back, so stand by.
KCAA Loma Linda, 1050 AM, K292 FQ Riverside, and K293 CF Moreno Valley.
If you knew there was a pipe cement that works better than the one you're currently using, is better for you and the environment, and costs the same or less, would you buy it? Oh, no-brainer, right? Weldon, the trusted leader in solvent cements for over 60 years, is pleased to introduce a new line of solvent cements that does all that. Introducing the Eco Series line of solvent cements for PVC piping systems. Not only does it work great and set fast, it also has 30% lower solvent emissions and less smelly fumes, a better workplace environment when you're installing pipes. But don't just take our word for it. EcoSeries products are the only solvent cements that are Green Seal certified for environmental innovation for effective performance, improved working conditions, and for use with potable water. Now available in a medium-bodied fast-setting blue formula, 905 Eco, and a regular-bodied fast-setting clear formula, 900 Eco. Pick up a can today from your local distributor and see, smell, and feel the difference, just like Joe Sweat, president of Sunrise Irrigation, did. He said, after using Weldon's 905 Eco, we immediately noticed the application was smooth and there was noticeably less odor than other blue solvent cements on the market. The guys love it. To learn more about Eco solvent cements from Weldon, Visit the website at www.welldone.com or call the technical service hotline at 877-477-8327. That's 877-477-8327.
Time to take a water break and talk some water. Irrigation. Such a refreshing topic. As more and more markets face water restrictions, your customers may be hungry, or should I say thirsty, for water-saving products. For new installations, add options like drip irrigation, controllers that respond to weather data, pressure-regulating heads, or heads with check valves. They all provide easy ways to differentiate your bids and win more jobs. Or for an extra stream of revenue, offer existing customers upgrades like high-efficiency nozzles, rotary nozzles, or Wi-Fi-based controllers. Because when you help your customers save water, you make a world of difference for the earth and your bottom line at the same time. We'll drink to that.
KCAA.
Hi, well, welcome back to the second half of the Water Zone, and we have some next guests that we got pre-recorded, and it's really interesting. You know, everybody talks about climate change in California, and you hear about climate change all over the world and this and that, but we experience different things in other states and other countries. And I thought we'd like to get a different perspective. So we have one of our friends named Greg Usoff from On Point TV. And he got a hold of some people from the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources, some interesting people. And it's nice to learn what other people in other places are thinking and how they approach it and what they do. So let's give a listen and see what we all learn.
Welcome, and thank you for joining us for this special Climate Week podcast. I'm Greg Husak, your host. I'll ask our guests to introduce themselves.
Hi, I'm Kenny Blumenfeld. I'm a climatologist with the DNR State Climatology Office, and I do a lot of outreach on the science of climate change in Minnesota especially. And I also manage a network of weather stations that we use to monitor the climate around Minnesota.
Hello, my name is Luigi Romolo. I am the Minnesota State Climatologist with the Minnesota State Climatology Office, and my work centers around two areas of focus, and those involve climate service and data management.
And I'm sure people listening may well be familiar with your voices and hearing and seeing your comments about climate here in Minnesota over the years, but particularly as we, during this climate week and looking forward as we talk about some of the specifics that are going on, maybe you can tell us a little bit more about what you do. You gave us a taste of that, but also the difference between climate and weather, because I think that's a question that a lot of people get hung up on.
Yeah, that's a great question. So that's a question that climatologists get almost every day. And so the best way to think about it is weather is the day-to-day variations of temperature and precipitation. And over a long period, approximately 30 years, if you average it, you get climatology. So if you have over 30 years of data at a particular location, then you could estimate or guesstimate what you might expect from the day-to-day variations in weather. So when you hear a forecaster say the high today might be 74, but the normal is 72, the 74 is the weather, the 72 is the climate.
Ah, and Kenny, maybe you want to expand on that a little bit too, as it relates to some of what we hear from people talking about. Well, what do you mean? It's, you know, 15 degrees below zero today. How can this indicate, you know, people tend to get very specific about
it. Well, so another handy, this is really convenient for us because, you know, also weather is usually, when we think of it, meteorology is about tomorrow or next week. And climatology traditionally has been about the past. Now, there's a whole branch of it that's focused on the future, too, because of the changing climate that we want to try and get a scientific understanding of. But if we just think about the difference between forecasting weather over the next few days or looking backwards and analyzing the climate as Luigi described it, one of the real advantages is that you hear the joke sometimes, oh, meteorologists are wrong, you know, half the time. And, well, we're climatologists, and we're just talking about what already happened, so we're right 100% of the time.
Correct.
You're in a more comfortable position now.
Yeah, yeah. In terms of, you know, one of the things that we try and, we're a scientific organization, a science-based organization, and we are also committed to educating our users. And so one of the things that we try and help people realize, which they can already intuit, is that the climate of Minnesota is wild. It's highly variable. It can be hot. It can be cold. It can go from hot to cold in a relatively short amount of time. And that's always been true, and that's probably always going to be true. But at the same time, there are these systematic changes, these trends in the temperatures that we've observed, these trends in precipitation that we've observed. And what that means is we have now a statistical, a scientific basis for knowing that it's gotten wetter or that it's gotten warmer. And even while that's happening, we still have the ups and the downs. So, of course, we're still going to have that 15 below, even as our winters get warmer. It's just that maybe the frequency of those 15 belows is going down, which we've actually seen. And, you know, maybe it doesn't get as far below zero as it used to. And that's also something we've seen. So we still can get wild swings, and we're still going to get cold. And the fact that we're warming doesn't disprove the, you know, doesn't mean that we'll never get cold again. And the fact that we get cold last week doesn't mean that we're not warming.
As we stretch out our thinking then and think more in terms of, you know, 30, 40, 50 years and beyond, for each of you, what are one or two of the key statistics that you cite when you look at how climate is changing more rapidly in Minnesota?
Yeah, so I think what Kenny's talked about with many of our media contacts that we've had throughout the year, one of the biggest issues that we're seeing right now is an increase in the extreme rainfall events that are occurring here in Minnesota, with a 20% increase in the number of 1-inch rains, a 65% increase in the number of 3-inch rainfall events. And these have profound impacts on rural communities with farming practices, and they have profound impacts in urban communities that are witnessing and observing strains to their infrastructure system, and probably the biggest observed impact here in Minnesota that we've seen so far.
Yeah, you want to say, so one of the things that we get, and someone might ask, well, what's a 1-inch rainfall? Who cares? And it is true, an inch of rain in a day in and of itself is not a big deal. It will ruin your picnic. You're gonna you won't play softball that night. But if in normal conditions, it's not that big a deal. But if you've been already wet, and I think what Luigi's kind of referring to, if you've already been wet or you're in an environment like a city, you can probably explain it better than me, where it's really hard to handle an inch of rain if it's already wet or if there's nowhere for the water to go, but especially if you get, you know, instead 3 inches of rain. And it's not like these are happening everywhere. It's just that they're becoming more common in general. You know, so the increases that we've seen, it doesn't mean every place in Minnesota every day of every year is going to get some, you know, bombarded by some, you know, massive rainfall event. Mm-hmm. It just means that, you know, the kinds of images you see of standing water, ponding water, submerged intersections, flooded basements, things like that, those are becoming more common. And not just because of more cameras to take pictures of it, but because, you know, they're actually more common.
Well, and certainly here in 2019, and again, trying to not just go by one snapshot, but people have been talking all year about the sustained high water conditions across much of the state, and that your indications are that that this will be a trend over the next 50 years that is expected to continue and to increase.
Yeah, so all the models are pointing in that direction, and so what we need to figure out is how to adapt to be able to essentially deliver this water efficiently through better infrastructure, better planned agricultural activity, and basically adapt in the best way possible.
And our floodplain planning, floodplain management planning,
correct,
and urban planning certainly come into the mix very much.
Absolutely.
As well.
So anything that we can mitigate is going to help us, or anything that we can do can help us mitigate those disasters down the road.
Yeah, it's actually kind of confusing sometimes too, because we have a trend towards wetter conditions. But the kind of wetness that we've had in 2019, 18, 17, and 16 is above that trend line, right? So one of the challenges of doing the work that we do is we have to try and, you know, if audiences really want the information, we have to say, well, yeah, this, we're on this trend towards wetter conditions. But that variation, the variability that we also talked about, we're really high on that curve right now too. So we have this trend. Plus, we have what must be this period of very high variability wetness, because we've never really seen anything like this. I mean, how many years, Luigi, are we, you know, we're talking year after year where we're breaking some kind of pretty significant precipitation record in the state. And what's Rochester as of late September already?
Yeah, around 44 inches.
Already broke its all-time annual precipitation.
Yeah, and we're here in the metro, we're on pace to break the record that was set just 2 years ago.
Right, and up in northwest Minnesota, we just, after almost a whole year where they were kind of lagging behind, northwest Minnesota was kind of looking at southern Minnesota saying, well, what's the big deal? It's not that wet. Well, then they get 5 to 7 inches of rain,
correct,
and they know what everyone's, you know, what everyone's talking about.
Sure. And as you talk about these ups and downs, does this mean then that in seeing these sustained high water levels and more extreme rainfall events, does that mean that we're not going to be experiencing drought in Minnesota?
Yeah, so that's a great question. And so we have what's called interannual variability, which is the variation of our weather from year to year, wet year, dry year, wet year, wet year, dry year, and so forth. And it just goes on and on and on. But we also have these long-term climate trends. And as Kenny was indicating, we're on a wetter trend right now. And we're projected to increase our amount of precipitation as we move forward in time. But drought is not dependent on, well, in this part of the world, it's not so much dependent on the long-term trends, but rather on the interannual variability. Mm-hmm. So no matter how wet we get, the soil can only hold so much water. And when it's holding all the water that it can, we call that field capacity. So any surplus water is just going to run off into the streams and rivers or percolate down into groundwater and fill our groundwater reserves. And so really only ever about 4 to 5 weeks of dryness away from drought. And it's unlike other hazards, it doesn't have a season. It doesn't have a distinct start to it. It creeps up on you. And no matter how wet we get, drought's always going to be right around the corner. And an example is down in New Orleans, they get about 60 inches of rainfall a year, and they still experience drought.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Would you say, I mean, one of the things that we talk about with temperature, and I assume it's true with precipitation, is that if we're getting warmer, we're still going to get cold sometimes. And what we're seeing with the cold is, it's not as extreme and not as frequent as it used to be, but we still get cold. The late winter of 2019, wow, that was a real winter. And we expect that for climatologically, that wasn't surprising. But I think if you get too used to this notion that it's only going to be warm winters for the rest of, for eternity now, then you will be really surprised by that. And I think the same is true for drought. We are certainly, we're on this pretty massive wet trend, but it would actually be irresponsible for us to assume that we wouldn't get drought.
Yeah, correct. So the thing that drives drought is the two meat and potato variables in meteorology. It's temperature and precipitation. And we're experiencing a warming trend, and we're experiencing a wetter trend. So if temperature was going up and precip was going down, then the issue of drought would probably be a larger issue. But because precip is going up and temperature is going up as well, we don't know what's going to happen. We have no clear view of how drought is going to be affected by climate change. And that's a scary thought.
Well, and I want to ask a question about that, but also something related to this whole measure of all these data that you're working with here. We held a Twitter town hall at the DNR this week on climate change, and we were hearing a lot of talk about a point of no return, and along with that question and whether we've reached that in some respects, it should be apparent to anybody listening here, I think, that you're not pushing an agenda. You're citing scientific data. You're citing statistics and hard data here, and this is the world in which you work. But along with the question about a point of no return, what do you say, Kenny and Luigi, when you go out, and I know you do lots of presentations around the state during the year, what do you say to people who deny the notion of human-driven climate change?
Ooh, okay, can we take these one at a time?
Let's break them down.
Can we take these one at a time?
Yes.
You know, I think, so whenever I'm out talking, we get that kind of point of no return question, and it becomes, you know, I don't want to use too big, it becomes existential at some point where we are asking, well, what do we mean? And return from what and to what? Mm-hmm. What is it that, is there some sort of idealistic climate point that we think we want to go back to? And so the question, as I think Luigi pointed out during that town hall, is, you know, it kind of depends on what you're looking at. For some things, we've already, you know, it's going to be hard to get them back. When you look at the rate of ice cover loss, for example, in the Arctic, it's going to be really hard to change that because the quality of ice has changed. And it's going to take hundreds of years to sort of redo that. There are other things where, you know, depending where we do have time. And actually, Minnesota, for as dire as some of our climate signals are, we're actually sitting relatively pretty compared to some of our neighbors. I mean, think of California. Mm-hmm. So I guess I'll let Luigi respond to the kind of point of no return question before we talk about this other piece.
All right.
And again, whenever Kenny or I or Pete go out and give a talk, we always get great questions like these. And some scientists are sometimes afraid to say, I don't know. And I've always been a proponent of it's okay and important to say, I don't know, when you don't know. And because we don't know when that cliff is coming, that point of no return, it's critical that we act now, we act quickly for the benefit of mitigating future impacts.
And speaking of that, we're going to have some information in just a moment about some of the things that the DNR is doing and has been doing in a very active sense in that regard. But Kenny, again, coming back to the question of what you say to those who deny the notion of human-driven climate change.
Well, I mean, you know, they come at it from a number of different angles. And, you know, we're a scientific and science-based organization. We're trained scientists, and our job is to, you know, it's not like we conduct all of the research that we are then kind of distilling for various audiences. Our job is to distill the science. And frequently the best way to do that is to read the larger assessments that have been done and then look at the peer-reviewed research that supports it. And then when you don't have any answers for a particular question, use the best available data and analysis. We can always fall back on that. We're scientists. And we would say this is what science shows. If you've got another idea that comes from another framework of seeing the world, okay, but our job is to report on the science. That's one piece, and honestly, sometimes that's even more combative than what's needed, because a lot of times, you know, we aren't political appointees, and a lot of times what happens is people come into this discussion because it is a political discussion for so many people. Mm-hmm. And we're actually just talking about facts that are totally apolitical. They're not political at all. And a lot of times, you know, it's helped for me to talk to some people in some areas where we're not really talking about climate change, and I put up quotes around that. We're just talking about what we've observed with changes in the weather and what you may have observed as, you know, farmers or as people who work outside or as, you know, just citizens of the state. And a lot of times, if we just describe the same things we've been talking about, but we're not pushing, this is climate change and this is, you know, your fault. And instead, we're just saying, this is what, you know, we've observed shorter winters with fewer cold extremes, longer and somewhat erratic growing seasons, more precipitation. A lot of times people in the audiences will say, well, yeah, I've seen that. I've had more water in my fields, or I absolutely haven't seen growing seasons like this. I've never seen field work and, you know, being done in October, late October, the way I've seen now. And then it sort of opens them up to ask the question, so what is it that you're talking about? And then we can discuss, we're talking about the science of climate change. And that's very different from, you know, the policy directives that might come out of it. That's just the experience that I've had, is that if you kind of lead with the evidence and the facts and make it a little bit about the stories that people might experience, they can relate to it pretty well.
Yeah. And I think anybody can really accept that perspective and in approaching it that way, appreciate that. We've got a number of good examples on the DNR website from DNR employees and others around the state of some of the impacts that they've been noticing in their daily lives, their professional lives, and their recreation. You can go to mndnr.gov/climate and select climate change to access some of those stories from Minnesotans and some other really helpful information. And in a minute, I'm going to talk a little bit. I have some questions for you about approaching freezing temperatures and getting into the cold season now, and overall what we mean when we talk about, you know, winters getting warmer and some of those things. So think about that for a moment as I just highlight some of the things that the DNR has been doing to deal with climate change. They've been doing a lot, and it's something the agency takes very seriously. So 10 years ago, in 2009, we formed a department-wide climate team known as CREST to help us create operational principles around climate change. One of the first things they did was develop a climate change handbook for the DNR. We should also mention the DNR has been actively involved in climate adaptation and mitigation on all of the land that we administer around the state. In terms of mitigation, we proactively manage lands to capture and store carbon and minimize greenhouse gases. In forests, this means planting and seeding thousands of acres every year to accelerate reforestation after a harvest or a natural disturbance. We're also planting different species of trees that will do better in these changing conditions. We adjust conservation focus areas to incorporate more grass and cover crops. On adaptation, we proactively manage invasive species and enact policies to minimize climate change impacts on ecosystems. For example, implementing an ash forest diversification project to prepare for emerald ash borer infestations. We're adapting to more frequent flooding by redesigning culverts to accommodate higher flows and connect rivers to their floodplains. And we're working with partners all over the state and in other states as well. Government agencies, local governments, all kinds of groups that are involved on this issue and engaged in urban planning, rural planning, flood management planning, and all the different things that we've been talking about today. Those are just a few examples, and there are many more. You can find a downloadable PDF fact sheet if you'd like to go to that same web location. Again, mndnr.gov/climate and select climate change. So as we move toward this winter season now, and the way I see it put here, the length of the frost-free season is increasing over time, and is expected to continue to increase through the century. So as we transition now from focus on water to a little more focus on temperature, what would you say are the big picture things for people to know as far as how winter weather is being affected?
Yes, so there's a few things that we can comment on right away, and you brought up the issue of frost-free season. The frost-free season refers to the length of time between the final frost in the spring to the first frost in the fall, and we've noticed that that period of time has increased roughly about 1 week across the state, a little bit higher in some parts of the states and a little bit lower in others.
Over what period of time are we talking about for that change?
Back to like the end of the 19th century.
Okay. Right, 1895.
All right. And so a week's difference in that,
right,
in that period of time.
Exactly. Right. So this could have profound impacts on our winter recreation and tourism industry. People take winter seriously here in Minnesota. I lived for a number of years in Louisiana where they didn't have snow, and they would actually relish if they just got a dusting of snow. Mm. People here make a living in the winter, whether it's through ice fishing or cross-country skiing or just going out and enjoying the winter cabins. The amount of time that we have with winter is important to us, and so these observations are being taken seriously.
Kenny, any key figures you'd cite or just things you're hearing commonly from people as you're out talking with people around the state?
I mean, you know, we could focus on the statistics, but a lot of times they're hard for people to understand. So yeah. We say, oh, winter's been warming over the long term at a half a degree Fahrenheit per
right.
decade. What does that really mean for people? Well, we can then translate that into some of the observations that we've gotten from people on the ground who aren't necessarily using thermometers to tell us what they've seen. A few years ago, we started getting calls, kind of distressed calls, and it was a bit alarming from resort owners and people who were representing and or writing about sort of the outdoor recreation in Minnesota, especially northern Minnesota, have been hit really hard because, you know, people who own resorts, their big time is the summer, but they get a sort of second season in the winter. And in the winter, it's about ice fishing. And if you can get people out who want to go fishing on your lake, then they will, you know, book cabins in advance. And if they book a cabin in advance, they might even need some help getting an ice house out onto the lake. Maybe they'll rent one. Maybe they'll rent a snowmobile. Maybe they'll buy, you know, refreshments too. And when they become uncertain if they're going to have ice, they cancel their reservations. And nobody's going up to these places, you know, because you can't hang out by the beach. So if there's no ice, people aren't going up.
Yep.
And we started getting, because of the frequency of those warmer winters and the less dependable ice season, we were starting to see effects of that on some of the, you know, the cabin industry, resorts and whatnot. But then we've also heard from, you know, people who operate ski hills. They really need not just dependable snow, because of course they can make their own snow, but to make their own snow they need a range of temperatures that's ideal for making snow. And if the temperature is above the highest part of that range, they can't do much with it. And so there's been a lot of concern, and of course people have seen, you know, canceled kind of major events in the region, the Birkebeiner, some of the dog sled races, some of the local cross-country ski races like the Twin Cities Lope, being canceled, even winter carnivals being canceled because, you know, you don't have the conditions. So we can tie that to numbers, a half a degree increase in winter temperature over the last 120 some years, half a degree increase per decade. But what it really means is, you know, shorter winters, as Luigi mentioned, less ice on the lakes, or at least a lower frequency or a shorter ice over season, and then somewhat puzzlingly, even though we've actually had the same amount of snow or even more snow during that time, the warmer conditions have really prevented us from realizing a real bountiful snowpack for much of that season. So it's actually, we can sort of tie it together numerically and also anecdotally.
We're moving toward the end of our time here, and we'll move toward some closing thoughts. I'm wondering how people can learn more, and certainly the resources like the DNR website provide some good basic information, but I don't know if either of you have other sources other than yourselves that, that you would recommend to people. And Kenny, I know you both worked on a development of an online data tool that people can access to find out more specifics about what's happening and some of the trends that are happening in different parts of the state. Maybe that's something that you might want to reference.
Yeah, so we have an online climate trends tool that it's really one of many. So this was kind of a large project, and people can click on any part of the state and can get the trend, or maybe it's no trend. They can see what's happened over time for temperature, precipitation, and some combined metrics for either an entire sort of year by year, or for a subset of months within a year, or for just, say, the growing season or just winter. And they can do it if they're interested in watersheds or counties. They can do it from a number of choices. And that, you know, I had mentioned we don't have a real simple URL for that, but Greg, what's the best way to find it?
Well, and again, just going to mndnr.gov/climate.
Yeah.
And you'll find those resources and that tool there.
Now, for deeper, we have a lot of friends and colleagues who really like to dive deep, and Luigi and his predecessor have made some great tools that are, kind of a station-by-station basis. You want to describe some of those, Luigi?
Yeah, sure. So a lot of these are map-based tools that allow users to click on a station, a location, whether it's Rochester or Albert Lee or Minneapolis or up north near Fargo or Grand Forks, and observe trends in precipitation or temperature. We have tools that show the year-to-date precipitation for different stations across the state. We have tools that show temperature and precipitation monthly anomalies. We had a really long trend of warm temperatures, warm monthly temperatures here in the metro. What was it, Kenny? Was it 20?
We had 20 months.
20 months in a row, and it ended the month after I started as the state climatologist here. I cursed it. But so lovely tools that were started by Jim Zandlo, continued on with Greg Spoden, and I've tried to hold up the tradition, and Kenny's done a great job with his climate trends tools. So we're very proud of all of those.
Well, we certainly greatly appreciate your expertise, not just your time here, but on an ongoing basis. It's meant so much to the DNR to have the State Climatology Office here as part of our Ecological and Water Resources Division. Thank you, Dr. Kenny Blumenfeld and Dr. Luigi Romolo, for providing your expertise and your perspectives here on this podcast. Thank you for joining us for this podcast. I'm Greg Husak.
Wow, what a great interview, don't you think, Chris?
I thought it was awesome. You know, when you think about, I mean, one of the things that inspired me about that, these guys are working in a fairly modern field of study, right? I mean, climatology hasn't been around for a long time. When I was taking physical and sciences, you know, there was a little bit on climatology, but not like it is today.
No, and I like where they said at the beginning, where they're not like the weather guys, and you know, they're more accurate. They don't do predictions.
That's right. Yeah, they only look at the past, so they're 100% right. I thought that was awesome as well. Hey, well, that was a good segment. I mean, we look forward to presenting that, and I'm glad our listeners could hear that tonight for those who tuned in.
Yep. Well, we're going to take away the show, and we're going to join everybody back next week, same time, same bat channel. And I hope all the listeners continue to keep listening. We do appreciate the audience, and you help make our show very great. And again, Chris Austin, for always joining us every week. So one thing that we always, Chris and I always tell everybody in the world to do at the end of our show is
duty our best.